Okay, I think we're alive. We're very happy to have Eric Kaufman here to present on academic freedom in crisis, punishment, discrimination, and self-censorship. And before we get to that, we've been asked by the Faculty Council at the University of Texas to begin all public events with the following statement. We would like to acknowledge, and they can't require it, but they really want to. So that may be related to some of the issues we're going to discuss. We would like to acknowledge that we are meeting on the indigenous lands of Turtle Island, the ancestral name for what is now called North America. Moreover, we would like to acknowledge the Alabama Coushatta, Caddo, Carrizo, Comacrudo, I don't know that one, Comanche, Kickapoo, Lipan Apache, Tonkawa, and Isleta del Sur Pueblo, and all the American Indian and indigenous peoples and communities who have been or have become part of these lands and territories in Texas. Anyway, take it away, Eric.
Okay, I didn't know that was required. It's interesting the Comanche were in there. We won't go into the history there. But anyway, I'm going to be just speaking about my research on academic freedom and the reason it's in crisis in the U.S., Canada, and Britain, and perhaps further afield. And it's kind of fitting that we're having this conversation given the announcement today of the University of Austin in the same city, of course, as UT. And I'm sort of one of the people who is sort of on the fringes of that. And so I'm going to be speaking towards the end of this. Once I go through the data on why there's a problem, I want to talk a little bit about some of the solutions to this problem, one of which could be the founding of new universities. So I'll just begin here with my slides. And so, yeah, I'm talking about academic freedom in crisis. And a lot of this stems from a couple of reports that I've done in the UK and then one in the US. There are two reports I did, one in 2019 with Tom Simpson of the University of Oxford, and then in August 2020 with Remy Adekoya at York and Tom Simpson as well. And then this was UK data. I then, more recently in March 2021, wrote quite a long report. I think it's 150 pages or thereabouts on academic freedom in crisis. And this really lays out in much greater depth and detail the data from not only the UK, but especially the US and Canada as well, building in also data from PhD students in North America and Britain. And a lot of the data kind of says the same thing. It speaks to the same sort of story and reveals very similar trends. And there are many different methods. In some cases, we are tapping sort of 70, 80, 85% of the potential pool. So there's no self-selection problem. In other cases, we have a much smaller share of our target audience that we capture in the survey. But I think the fact they're all speaking to each other tells us that there's a strong reliability and external validity to this data. In terms of academic freedom, then, the model that I want to sort of outline to you today consists really of two drivers. One is punishment, what I call hard authoritarianism, that is threats to fire you, to punish you. The other is a softer, at least what appears to be a softer form of authoritarianism, which is political discrimination. So we've got punishment on the one hand over here, and we've got political discrimination over here. And both of these are issues in contemporary higher education for faculty and for students as well. The upshot of these two forces is to create a chilling effect. People are afraid of being punished, not only fired, but perhaps demoted or not given research funding or the teaching they want or the positions or grants or research refereed articles that they want. On the other hand, we have political discrimination. Again, you don't want to, this is about not being fired, this is about not being hired or promoted. So you don't want to put your cards on the table politically if they are the wrong cards, because that will lead people in committees of various kinds to discriminate against you and prevent your career advancement. So both of those things lead to chilling effects and chilling effects to self-censorship, which is, this is where academic freedom, self-expression are circumscribed and restricted by these two forces, punishment and political discrimination. What that then produces is a conformity and a hostile climate for dissidents, not only people who are already in the academy, but those who might want or who are thinking about going down the track of getting a PhD and going into academia, but who have the wrong ideas, are put off by the hostile climate. What that then does is it keeps them out of academia, and people who don't want, who can't really take the discrimination and authoritarianism leave. And so what you get is a purification process, an increasingly politically undiverse monoculture of conformity. And Cass Sunstein's book, Conformity, talks a lot about the fact that conformity is enforced not just through formal disciplinary punishments, but also through informal social ostracism and exclusion. And both of those things then, once you get the more conformist, the more of a skew, in the case of academia, the more of a skew to the left and an increasing share on the hard left, that actually makes these problems worse. It makes the political discrimination worse. Even if individuals remain as discriminatory as they were, once the balance shifts from, for example, one left to one right to 10 left to one right, then the discrimination of the 10 impacts much more heavily on the one than the discrimination of the one. And so that is where this is exacerbated. And similarly, John Ellis and Cass Sunstein have both talked about how the more you get everybody on the same page politically and ideologically, the more room there is then for fundamentalists to emerge, who are simply exemplifying the community's values, but in an extreme way. And they know they have the values of the community that they're representing. And what that does is it leads to incentives for people to push towards the extreme, not to push to the middle, but to push towards the extreme. And that's why we get an increase in cancellation and denouncements and all of the things we associate with cancel culture in a politically monocultural environment. This reinforces the chilling effects, the self-censorship, the hostile climate that keeps dissenters away, keeps them out of the system, further purifying the system, and you're into this feedback loop and self-reinforcing spiral. So let's just put some numbers on some of these things. I'm going to talk about punishment first. Remember, we were talking about punishment, or the hard form of authoritarianism, and political discrimination, the soft form. So we'll deal with punishment first. Let's look at some of the trends in terms of the high profile stuff. The first is the Scholars Under Fire database released by the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education earlier this year in September. And what they showed was essentially a fivefold increase since 2015 in the number of these targeting incidents, from just under 30 to around 120. So you've had a big expansion in incidents targeting academics, hoping to fire them. And the result has been actually an increase in the number of sanctions, here in red. So there's been a big increase in the punishment that's gone on campus since 2015. We have statistics also from the Fire Disinvitation Database in the US. The number of disinvitation incidents has been rising to a peak around 2018, a bit of a drop back up in 2019. The general level is considerably higher in the 2010s than in the 2000s. Here's in a couple of time series from Britain. One is all no platformings, and the other is no platformings and sanction incidents related to gender critical feminists who are critical of the idea that you can self-identify as a woman, for example, rather than being biologically a woman. So we've seen a big spike in Britain as well. It's a little bit later than the US, but we're seeing a similar trend. So we've got the trends in the punishments and disinvitations. And there's a whole set of comments that emerged in our survey, in the survey that I administered in the US and Britain. So for example, one says, because of innocuous items I posted on a private blog, I think I'll be all right, but conservative academics are somewhat persecuted for their views. And that's a conservative geographer in the US. A centrist, politically centrist classics professor in Canada talks about the attitude of the administration turning to more punitive measures recently. So we're careful what we say. And a British conservative Leave voter, that someone who voted to leave the European Union, which is a view only held by about 10% of academics, in the social sciences and humanities, said, "I've lost two jobs because I voted leave." So here's just some qualitative evidence as well. In terms of one of the questions that was asked by a survey conducted in 2017 of a very large number of academics, 4,000 in the European Union, 2,300 in Britain, people were asked if they had been disciplined or threatened with discipline in a whole range of different areas, teaching, research, non-public forum, public forum, elsewhere. And what you see here in general is somewhere between 5 and 10% of academics in the EU and Britain have been disciplined or threatened with discipline on any of these one measure, any of these single measures. Combined, if we take Britain, this is the UCU sample, which is the main union for academics in Britain, 11% have experienced at least one of these. So the rate of being disciplined or threatened with discipline for speech in teaching, research, and elsewhere is about 11% in Britain in 2017. I asked this question on my US, US and Canada surveys for PhDs and academics. Now, I don't have a large number of conservative PhDs and academics, about 40 to 45 in both samples. If we combine these two samples, we get about 90. One in three US and Canadian PhDs, this is largely a US sample, about 90%. So one in three of these North American academics are reporting either being threatened with discipline or actually having been disciplined for speech in one of these categories. Much higher for PhDs than for academics. I also did a survey of National Association for Scholars Academics. And here you see similarly very high numbers. Now, the NAS does attract people who are very strongly committed to free speech. And so to some extent, there is a self-selection issue there. But still, when we're talking about one in three PhDs and academics having experienced at least one of these forms of punishment, that's quite a large number. We can't just say, oh, this is just a few no platformings and a few firings. It's 0.001% of the total faculty. No, this is actually one in three that have been disciplined or threatened with discipline. So that is actually quite a significant problem on the punishment side. If we look at attitudes amongst academics, it's sort of to punishment and cancellation. In some ways, it's good news that only about one in 10 on any of these controversial topics, the idea that diversity has a negative impact on social solidarity. I mean, these are hypothetical scenarios that were presented to respondents of findings that hypothetical researchers report. So if someone reported, for example, that higher diversity leads to lower solidarity, or the British Empire did more harm than good, or traditional parenthood has better outcomes for children than non-traditional, or a higher share of women and minorities, lower performance in an organization. These are all couched as sort of highly controversial findings. They're not real findings, but they're just hypothetical findings. And then the last question is really an academic who thinks that immigration should be reduced in general. Should that person be fired? If there's a campaign to fire them, would you support it? And what we find is it's about one in 10 that, and this is from the UK data, about one in 10 support these firing campaigns for controversial speech. So that doesn't seem like a lot. And in some ways, that's really good news. On the other hand, what I'd also point out to you is that if we look at the opposition to firing campaigns, it is significant at about 50% for three of the questions. It's lower, it's at about 27% for this fourth question. But what this means is there is a significant gray zone of people who are neither in support of these cancel campaigns or opposed to them. And that's 40 to 60%. Very significant amounts, very significant levels of uncertainty here, really. So these are people who are, you know, they're not in favor of cancel culture. They find that distasteful. But on the other hand, they're actually not opposed to it. Even on a survey, this has nothing to do with being scared. This has nothing to do with preference falsification. And so this is not spiral of silence, silent majority stuff. And I think it's very important to understand this gray group here, who really are torn. They are, in my view, in tension between their free speech values and their progressive values about always favoring the oppressed, the underdog against the putative oppressor. And so preventing some kind of emotional harm to an underdog is a very powerful motive for a lot of academics. If we take this question on restricting immigration, what you see is overwhelming opposition. Hey, if somebody advocates for lower immigration, that's not something that reaches the same threshold as some of these other questions in terms of controversy. Very few people are undecided on this question the way they are undecided on these other questions. The data from the US and Canada on a slightly larger sample compared to the UK, almost identical. You can see almost the same pattern here. And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail other than to say it's that same issue of a small share in favor of actively canceling, about half or thereabouts opposing, but also a significant group that are torn. Now, I asked those five questions, which are listed here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the five issues. And here I'm comparing across five different surveys in the US and Britain. These three are academics. These two are PhDs. The green bar is an amalgamation that says, okay, did you say yes to any of these five cancel campaigns? And in the case of the US academics, about 1 in 4. And similarly in the UK, and these are just social sciences and humanities academics, about 1 in 4 favor or are willing to back at least one of these cancel campaigns. It's 1 in 5 in Canada. So somewhere between 1 in 5 and 1 in 4. Amongst PhDs, you can see the green bars are much higher. Amongst US and Canadian social science humanities PhDs, it's 1 in 2. So 50% of those US and Canadian PhDs support at least one of these firing campaigns. And in the UK, it's getting on 40%, so significantly higher amongst PhDs compared to faculty. Now, in terms of predictors of supporting at least one of these campaigns, there are two key variables. One has to do with ideology. So saying you are very left-wing on a 5-point very left to very right scale, the very left are really distinct from the somewhat left. It's the very left that are really very much behind the support. You can see the fairly left, that's not statistically significant. So very left and also younger people. Age is very important, even when we control for ideology. So a centrist who is younger is more pro-cancel than a centrist who is older. A far leftist who is younger is very much more pro-cancel than a far leftist who is older. Age has an independent effect from ideology. And that's the UK. Here's the US. It's a slight reordering, but pretty much the same story. It's just that in the US-Canada case, age is actually even more important than being very left. And so this is telling us something interesting, which is, first of all, yes, we can probably guess that the idea of trying to protect vulnerable minorities from harm is a left-wing idea. It's sort of what I call a culturally left or culturally socialist idea. But in addition to that, you've got this generational thing, which I think is probably the most important point, which is we are going to see, I would argue, increased cancel activity and not decrease, because we've got a generation coming up that is considerably less tolerant of dissent along the key sacred values of the cultural socialist religion or the woke religion, which is around race, gender, and sexuality. So controversial views on those, very low toleration. And there's a recent paper from Morris Levy, Jack Citrin, and colleagues that show this in the GSS data, tracking this from 1972. So this is not simply a matter of something people are going to grow out of. There's a generational cohort aspect to this. We can see this across the five different or six different surveys here. If you compare academics 35 and under with academics 50 plus, 35 and under academics in Britain, it's about 1 in 3 that support at least one dismissal campaign. In the US and Canada, it's about 40%, 0.4 chance that they'll support at least one of these. Whereas for those in the over 50s, it's half as prevalent. It's only about 0.10 to 0.15 compared to 0.33 to 0.4. Now, if you look at North American PhDs, they have who are under 35, 0.56, greater than 50% chance of supporting at least one of these five cancel campaigns. So there's a big age profile difference, and we've got a cohort effect. Now, it may be that the millennials stand out from Generation X and the boomers, whether there's a step change effect, I can't say for sure. It seems more of a linear age effect, but whatever the case is, this would suggest the problem's going to get worse, not better, as the millennials become a larger share of academia. Another point I want to make, though, is that this isn't a problem that is confined to academia. This is a survey that I conducted, results of which have not yet been fully released, of non-academics. And what you find is the top two predictors for supporting at least one of these hypothetical cancel campaigns is being a strong Democrat. I could have used the left-right scale. Strong Democrat as a sort of simile with very left. And age. Similarly, younger people being dramatically more, and it's reverse sign. Don't worry about that. The effect is the same direction, which is younger people are significantly more willing to back punishment and for speech on the sacred identity totems. And we can see that also, again, sticking with a non-academic survey, was Google right to fire James Damore for essentially pushing or questioning the gender equity policies of Google? 67%, two-thirds of the 18 to 25s, and a little over one-third of the 50 pluses. So that kind of shows you, again, this powerful impact of generation, even when controlling for the left-right. It's not because these people who are younger are more left-wing. It's not. They're not actually that much more left-wing. It's controlling for the left-right dimension. Age really matters. And so those who think this is some McCarthyite blip, I think, are not really seeing the depth of the problem that we face. I mentioned, by the way, when I talked about academics in US and UK, that they were torn between their free speech values, which are real, and academics very much are in favor of free speech. But on the other hand, they're also strongly in favor of protecting minority groups. And what's really interesting is when you put these two questions together, and this is a question that YouGov in Britain have been asking for a while, thinking about political correctness. Are you in favor of it because it protects against discrimination, or against it because it stifles freedom of speech? What you see in the British public, it's 47% against political correctness to 37 in favor, using this wording. If we take academics in my sample that could be matched to the YouGov panel, 64 to 31 in favor of political correctness. And then if we take currently active social science humanities academics in my YouGov survey that could be matched to the panel, 76-20 in favor of political correctness. And I think that's sort of showing you how much those progressive values, when pitted against the free speech values, they trump them. Now, of course, the meaning of political correctness is obviously not made 100% clear. If this question was, do you think someone should be fired? No doubt the support would drop considerably, but it does suggest there's a very powerful kind of progressive, always on the side of the underdog and against the oppressor kind of motive going on with a lot of academics that leads them to be in value conflict when we raise a question like, do you think somebody who reports controversial findings about diversity in organizations and whether it's a good or a bad thing, should that person be fired? Well, they might not say yes, but they might not say, oh, no, I would oppose their firing. And I think we've got an ideological issue here and not simply an issue of preference falsification. So I've talked a lot about punishment. I've talked about fear of punishment. I've talked about support. And support for cancellation and firing, so support for punishment. I now want to just pivot and talk briefly about softer authoritarianism, in other words, political discrimination. And with political discrimination, there have been a number of different studies, the Inbar and Lammers 2012, Honeycutt and Freeberg 2017, there's Lee Jessam and colleagues in 2020. There's been a bunch of these studies. They all find the same thing, that there is significant political discrimination. General, some find the right discriminate against the left as much as the left against the right, which, by the way, is the general finding in society. But some of the elite, some of the findings for elites, sort of people, you know, elite students, well-educated people, university faculty would suggest in some cases that there's a stronger bias against the right. But it doesn't actually matter very much whether the bias is equal. When, even if you have individuals being equally prejudiced against the other side ideologically, if you have a skew in the makeup of an organization like a university, if the pattern as it is in the social sciences and humanities is 10 to 15 to 1 left to right, then the prejudice of the 1 against the 15 hardly makes a difference, whereas that of the 10 to 15 against the 1 means the prejudicial effect falls disproportionately on conservatives or gender critical feminists or whoever is the minority. So the problem structurally is proportional to the ideological skew. The bigger the ideological skew, the worse the effect of political discrimination on political minorities, such as conservatives or gender critical feminists. If we look at some data here, if we, in the surveys, when I ask people, would you discriminate against a known Trump supporter in hiring? 22% will openly say so in the US, 27% in Canada. In Britain, 10% would discriminate against a known supporter of leaving the European Union in the Brexit referendum. And that's a result which incidentally went 52 in favor of leaving, 48 against in the general public. But amongst academics, it's only around 10% of currently active social sciences and humanities academics that would support the Brexit vote. I also conducted a list experiment, which allows us to get at the revealed willingness to discriminate. And here, 40% of American academics revealed that they would be willing, that they would discriminate against a known Trump supporter. 45% of Canadian academics would discriminate against a known Trump supporter. And about a third of British academics would discriminate against a known Brexiteer. So that is pretty significant levels of discrimination politically. And academics aren't stupid. Dissenters know that, and they know that they're going to keep, if they have those views, they're going to keep them to themselves, which is why if you take all of American academics, only about 15% say a Trump supporter would share that view with their colleagues. And that's not Trump supporting academics. That's all academics in the sample. These are mostly Biden voters. So I think, and similarly in Britain, it's about 3 in 10 for even Remain voting. Social science humanities academics recognize that this is not a wise thing to do, is to let everyone know you voted for Brexit. And then, of course, there's the literature that looks across a wider range of different tests of discrimination, journal article submissions, promotion applications, and grant bids. In terms of people being openly willing to say that they would discriminate against a conservative or right-leaning paper submission, it's 12%. It's about 10-12% across the US, Canada, UK for papers and promotion applications, but for grant bids, it's closer to 20 to 25%. So 20 to 25% would openly discriminate against a grant bid. Now, this is not a list experiment revealed numbers. If we took the revealed numbers, I would guess that they would be sort of in the neighborhood of about 20 to 45%. And in fact, there have been studies that find those kinds of numbers in other samples. The other thing to note is that PhD students in North America and Britain are considerably more discriminatory, especially on paper submissions and grant bids. So about 1 in 4 North American and British PhDs would discriminate against a right-leaning journal article submission. And for grant bids, it's around 30%. That's openly admitted. Okay, this is not concealed. This is openly admitted. So we have discrimination on the hiring front and on the paper submission, promotion application, and grant bid front. What that leads to is obviously chilling effects for political minorities and self-censorship and the loss of academic freedom as a result. So the question was put to academics in the social sciences and humanities. Is your department a hostile climate for your political beliefs? And if we take those who are the small minority who identify as right-leaning in the US, 70% of right-leaning academics reporting a hostile environment. In Canada, 58% of conservatives, and in the UK, it's sort of 60-75, depending on which survey we're using. Centrists, actually, in the US, 35% are reporting a hostile environment, and it's about sort of 20% or 20-30% in Canada. It's a little lower in Britain. And the group that reports the lowest is the center left the moderate left. The very left reports somewhat more hostility than the center left. In terms of self-censorship, reporting that you self-censor in your research, teaching, or discussions, in the US, 70% of social science humanities academics say they self-censor. In Canada, it's 56%, in Britain, 50%. Again, this is on the right. Centrists in the US case, 42%, in Canada, 47%. So there's a lot of self-censorship going on among centrists in North America, less so in Britain among centrists, and there's less on the left. So we're getting quite a bit of people picking up on a hostile climate. They're self-censoring as a result of punishment and political discrimination. And this is, I'm not going to go into this detail other than to say previous studies have shown pretty much the same sort of thing. Significant discrimination against the right, significant reporting of hostile climate amongst conservatives. A paper recently came out from Pippa Norris of Harvard University on cancel culture. This was a survey called the World of Political Science Survey. Asked three questions. Has the following gotten better or worse in the past 5 years? Pressures to be politically correct, number one. Number two, freedom to teach and research. Number three, respect for open debate. A 50 score means things hadn't changed in the last 5 years. Below 50 means things have gotten better. Above 50, things have gotten worse. And you can see even amongst leftists and moderates, they're reporting above 65, meaning that things have gotten worse. And those on the right are reporting sort of 80 or in some cases up to almost 100 in terms of 100% of people saying things have gotten worse. So this is across a range of Western countries. The evidence seems to be pretty overwhelming that things have gotten worse in the last 5 years. So what does that then mean for viewpoint diversity? You've got this hostile climate arising because of punishment and discrimination. If in this survey, which mixes US, Canada, and Britain, master's and PhD students, the share of graduate students saying my political beliefs could make my life difficult, much higher clearly with those among those with right-wing views than among those with left-wing views. So what signal is this sending to people who might want to go down the track of pursuing an academic career? The research, which I can't get into here in much depth, shows that it's at the master's level amongst conservative social science humanities students that they are essentially not pursuing an academic career, and this is a significant reason for that. And so just returning to that model, then again, we've got punishment, we've got political discrimination producing chilling effects and hostility, hostile environments leading to self-censorship that dissuades prospective political dissenters and minorities from entering the profession. That then leads, and it also leads some who are in it, who are political minorities, to leave or retire early, which is something I also show in the report. That leads to a purification of the moral community around progressive values, intolerant progressive values. A conformity sets in, which worsens both punishment and political discrimination and all of these chilling effects and self-censorship. And you're into the spiral. And what that produces over time is here, if we look at the UK, it's 1.5 essentially voting for a left-wing party compared to a right-wing party in 1964. 1.5 to 1, those numbers are very similar in the US if you look at Lipset and Ladd and their work. So it goes from 1.5 to 1 in the mid-60s, By the time we get to sort of late 80s, early 90s, it's about 2-1 left to right. Similarly, in the U.S., using Sam Abrams' numbers here, it's about 2-1 far-left liberal versus right conservative in the 1989-90. By the time we get into the 2010s, it's 6-1 in the U.S. and 5-1 in Britain. So we've seen a big shift even since the 1990s. The left is now overwhelmingly dominant. Now, this is all of academia. It's STEM as well as social sciences and humanities. But it just leads to an incredibly skewed profile. Now, I want to say one other thing, which is that the cultural left, I would argue, has been culturally intolerant from the beginning. I'm quoting here Nathan Glazer writing in 1969 about the Berkeley free speech movement. Started out talking about free speech. But for Glazer, what's happened is that this movement, as it gained strength, became illiberal and authoritarian. So the right of unpopular political figures to speak without disruption on campus, the right of professors to give courses and lectures, again, without disruption, to have open discussion, and to engage in research they've freely chosen, all of these have been attacked by the so-called free speech movement. And so that's, I think, very important to understand that the ideology is not really new. It's just that it's been scaled up and institutionalized to a much greater extent. And so that enables more extreme manifestations to rear their head. Question then becomes, okay, what do we do about this? And I think it's worth thinking about the problem in terms of four tiers. We have ideas that are seen to violate progressive taboos, such as the empire has done more good than bad, or diversity worsens performance, or any of those hypothetical scenarios that I laid out in my surveys. So these questions cannot really be asked, or the answers cannot really vary from a script. You then have tier two, where these are essentially findings that you can report, but they're near impossible to publish. So the idea that support for critical race theory is damaging the Democrats' vote, or that rioting and protest impact on crime rates, or that Asian Americans aren't discriminated in the labor market. I mean, these are all drawn, some of them are drawn from actual real life cases, but it makes your life very difficult in conferences. And the problem is academia is a collegial profession. So you got to publish with your peers in front of an audience of peers, your colleagues in your department on committee and so on, have a lot of power over your future and over your quality of workplace life. So these are opinions which, again, you're probably not going to want to express, and these are questions you're not going to investigate. Tier three are the difficult, but you're not going to get canceled. You're not necessarily going to be ostracized, but you're cutting against the grain. So even something like, you know, the idea that national identity is not a construction of instrumental elites or state systems, but it's actually something people are emotionally attached to and rooted in. People do express that view in the discipline, but it's something that's just you're pushing against the grain, and it's harder to get published. Or that there's a strong hereditary component to SAT scores and so on. That's an example of a difficult but not near impossible. And then we get to tier four, which is simply the fact that, okay, the ideas can be published, but there's simply not a lot of resources going towards them. They're unfashionable, and there are not a lot of hires in this direction in military history or high politics or modernization theory or classical architecture. You're not going to get a lot of new investment and hiring in those areas because they are frowned upon by the general direction of the discipline. And so there's also going to be a drift towards, again, critical social justice subjects around race, gender, and inequality are going to get more resources. That's, again, what I would call a tier four problem. It's not. And what I think is, so you go from the taboo breaking all the way down to simply things that are unpopular or unfashionable given the current. And the question is, how do we address these problems? What might be ways to attack them to make the academy work in the direction it's supposed to, which is to be a truth-seeking enterprise that really searches for truth and pays attention to the most important problems. Well, one solution, of course, is something like the University of Austin. New universities announced today. The idea of the new university of Austin is that it will allow people to openly discuss the taboo subjects or those that are near impossible to investigate. And here I think actually new universities really do have a role, new academic journals, a new ecosystem that will allow forbidden subjects to be investigated and taught. And so here I definitely think new universities are the answer. But I also think there are limits to new universities. I think that new universities can address these very, very taboo subjects, and that's where you need them. But I also think because academia is not a free market and because of the network effects of reputation, of alumni, of endowments and status systems, I just think this makes it very, very difficult for new entrants to break in. And this is one of the reasons why I don't think you can get creative destruction and new universities essentially leading the established ones to reform in order to compete and good ideas driving out the bad. I think that is an idealized libertarian model, and I actually don't think it's likely to happen in the university system. So we do need the new universities to get at the really taboo stuff and the very difficult to publish stuff. But I also think the bigger necessity is government-led intervention and regulation. And this is anathema to a libertarian, but I also ultimately think it's the only real way to get at the reform of the system writ large, which I think will largely remain in place, especially at the elite level where the influence comes from. And so for a whole set of reasons, the network effects that I mentioned, you know, the rich kind of get richer in a way. The high status places retain their high status. People have an investment in that high status, and there's just too much inertia there and feedback effects. And so the problem of tiers 2, 3, and 4, not the taboo subjects, but the ones where it's difficult to publish in or where there's no funding going to the subjects because they're unfashionable. There, I think we need to have a different approach. The kind of approach I think we need to see is that, first of all, I don't think universities can reform themselves. Every so often you'll get the stars aligning and you'll get a certain group of academics and administrators favoring free speech. Maybe this happened at the University of Wisconsin briefly in the 2000s, which John Ellis talks about. But generally speaking, I think this is going to be rare. The direction of travel is towards more what I call cultural socialism, progressive values, trumping free speech values. And therefore, I think, you know, we can look at speech codes, which have been in place for 30 to 40 years. These things aren't going away, and they're not going to reform themselves. Increasingly, as the new generation comes in that's less tolerant, that'll only get harder. And so I think here we really need the government to step in. The UK case, the Director of Academic Freedom, this is legislation I've been involved in advising. They took a lot of recommendations from our think tank report. The idea behind this new Director of Academic Freedom is to create a free speech bureaucracy that can offset the equality bureaucracy. It'll be an office of 10, roughly 10 individuals who will proactively issue guidance to universities. They have the power to fine universities if they do not both protect and promote academic freedom. And universities have a whole new set of free speech duties. Now, it's very important, of course, to get the right people in as director and in staffing the office who believe in this mission. So this is political. There's no real way around that. It's linked to policy networks outside of politics and inside of politics that can staff these bodies with people who believe in this mission. It has to be made very clear in the legislation that the freedom of speech and academic freedom duties override and trump those related to subjective definitions of harm, harassment, and reputational damage, not allowing those rationales to be used by universities, which they typically do. Universities essentially break the law. They essentially interpret it the way they want to. This office would proactively ensure they don't do that. It would allow people to appeal around their own universities for their complaints to be heard by an ombudsman. And so what that will do is it will more or less keep universities on the straight and narrow through proactive regulation. And I think that is the only real way to fix the problem of cancel culture and chilling effects related to fears of being fired and disciplined. But of course, that deals then with only one part of the problem, which is which is academic freedom, there's also the issue of political discrimination and the loss of viewpoint diversity. And here I think we need to use a number of different procedures, which are not unfortunately officially enshrined in the UK's academic freedom bill, but could be a further step. One is to have robust procedures against political discrimination. Every time you're on a hiring committee, you get the spiel on not discriminating on protected characteristics. Well, political belief is now a protected characteristic in the UK after a recent court case. That needs to be made very clear that you cannot discriminate politically. Secondly, the implementation of the recommendations of the 1967 Calvin Report at the University of Chicago, that universities should not be taking any position on social issues. They need to be politically neutral. If they aren't neutral, then that actually impinges upon the freedom of academics, because they will then be seen as, oh, if I'm advocating this position, I'm going against my employer. And so the employer should not be taking positions, all levels, in my view, of the university, from the president all the way down to department heads. None of them should advocate political positions when they're acting in an administrative capacity. They can do it, but they have to preface it by saying they're speaking in a personal capacity. Creating a politically neutral environment is, I think, vital. And then finally, if we want to talk about diversity and equity around race and gender, my view is that we should have equivalent action between race and gender and ideology and politics, political diversity. So indexing any action on race and gender diversity and equity to action on political diversity, I think that would introduce a very important discipline in this whole problem. Okay, I know I've said a lot. I'm going to stop there and take questions from Richard. Okay.
Thanks. Thanks so much, Eric. That was very interesting data. It's a little depressing. And I guess we'll just start out. Are we really so far gone at a place like the University of Texas that our only hope is to either start a brand new university or bring in reform from outside? Sorry, that's a rhetorical question. Obviously, there's no question of that. Attempting to reform internally, as I think you know, that I might have some insight into this, completely impossible. No support whatsoever internally. But I have the problem that, like, what's happening in the UK with the free speech bill, there's actually some engagement there. Like, what's striking is, like, even in Texas, which is a very conservative state, at least relatively speaking, absolutely no interest from people above and in fact, they'll switch sides and come after you if you try to reform the university. So is there anything we can do about that? Like, why is it that,
You say people above, you mean legislators?
Yeah. The only thing they care about is that we switched from the Big 12 to the SEC. They got real upset about that.
Right.
But, anything else is just like, oh, how dare you criticize the university, go away, you people. What do we do to make people who could have influence care at all?
Well, I think that's a failure of the political class, say the concern, if you're talking about Texas, this would be the state Republican Party.
I didn't say that. You did.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I disagree with a lot of the, I'm not down the line with the Texas Republicans. I wish they would focus less on certain issues like abortion and more on this. But what I would say is that, this has to be a political issue that parties need to raise. The way this works is that parties can raise the salience and conservative media can raise the salience of an issue. We've seen that recently with critical race theory in schools. Similarly, you could raise the salience of an issue like authoritarianism and lack of freedom on campus. I mean, that in Britain, I would say that's gotten a lot of press in the papers. There's a kind of interlocking between the press and the government making statements. So the Kathleen Stock affair, this is a gender critical feminist who was essentially, people came in chanting to get her fired and she's eventually left. I mean, that's been all over the last few weeks. What's that?
I believe that story may circle back around to some other things you mentioned.
Yeah. So there's real political momentum in the press and amongst politicians. But you know what I would say is the way this happened, because I was kind of privy to a lot of it, is that you need a policy network, people outside academia like academics and think tanks with connections to the policy people in the government, and you need a sort of channel and saying, hey, why, well, we got to get, let's try and get this on the manifesto. Once it's on the manifesto, then they'll at least have to respond to it. And then, and you've got these different factions within, you need to interest enough politicians to actually take this up and to show that it can be a vote winner, first of all. And so I think increasingly that momentum's happened in Britain, but it's a bit like you need to be mobilized to some degree. It's a kind of like the Federalist Society with the Supreme Court. You need something similar for staffing of bodies that are going to be important in essentially upholding this. So yeah, it takes a certain amount of momentum, and it takes the political elite to recognize that this is an issue people care about.
Yeah. I guess, you know, when you live it, it just seems so obviously a problem, but yeah, you know, I guess the salience is really an issue. I mean, we've had some success at UT, you know, we've had court decisions, like we had a blatantly unconstitutional thought crime snitch line that got shut down, but then they're just like rebuilding it with, like, you know, around the edges, like, you know, the internal processes just seem so focused on perpetuating this here, at least. And it's odd because everyone's appointed by, you know, as you, the Republican Party of Texas, but they're, you know, absolutely, we need a thought crime snitch line.
Yeah, but if those people were exposed in the press, if they were exposed on social media and saying, hey, your legislatures are voting in favor of this, and that was in the media, and they were embarrassed, or if, for example, people in the policy unit in the government were saying, hey, what's going on here, and putting pressure, it seems like there's just not, it isn't joined up, to use a British expression, you know, there doesn't seem to be, the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. So yeah, I think that's a lack of political organization and making this issue more important for politics, which, you know, of course, the side that's pushing the censorship, they like it that way. They want to be under the radar and make sure that they want to say this is a moral panic and this shouldn't be in politics. But increasingly, I think people are realizing that it's in that middle layer of organizations, not the government, not the citizens. It's this middle layer where a lot of the repression is coming from, because the activists are driving at these institutions, and these institutions are signing up to all of these schemes that make them turn the ratchet more and more, just to compete with each other to see who's doing more equity and diversity.
So that kind of leads, that middle tier that does all this and pushes so hard, that leads me to this sort of, I don't think it's actually a paradox, but there is this idea of a paradox. Like, how do you have an environment that is open to all ideas if, like, most of the ideas on campus now are sort of focused on, no, we should shut down other people's ideas? Can we have a situation where we're tolerant of this idea that everyone who disagrees with me should be shut down, which is, I think, the sort of, you know, postmodern critical theory, pretty explicitly, that's their idea. Should we tolerate that? Or do we need to just sort of say, we're only going to tolerate people who are willing to tolerate other people? Is that a mechanism we can build?
Well, no, you can have critical social justice people teaching and researching, you know, as long as they don't actually have power to implement their philosophy, then yeah, I think you want to have them around. I think it's okay to have those ideas around. I wouldn't want to ban critical social justice in universities. I mean, it's different in schools. There, I think there's a legitimate case, but I think in universities, no. But what I would say is you need to have external intervention. The thing will never fix itself. And it's a bit like a corrupt police department, or, you know, even when the universities were segregating Black students, in the University of Mississippi, you know, the federal government had to desegregate. I mean, it's a violation of the university's autonomy in order to achieve, to protect liberty. And that's what we're talking about, is when these institutions are corrupt and they're violating people's individual rights, the government coming in and restraining those institutions is actually protecting liberty and enabling freedom. So the government is an agent of freedom in these cases. It isn't obviously in a Turkey or a China, but in Western cases, it very much is going to have to be a big part of the solution, I think.
And that's an interesting point, because I have this argument with people who are sort of more on the far libertarian side, and they're very focused on, you know, what's the underlying principle that would set this up? But we can't have any government interference, because then, you know, different situations call for different action, right? So that I think that's sort of the point. I think that's a very good point, and the need for some sort of subtle thinking about what's going on. So,
yeah, another example I could throw out is when the Berlin Wall came down and all of the East German universities were full of Marxist-Leninist historians. And, you know, essentially they, you know, you have to sort of toe the Marxist line. Well, you know, the German government basically said, well, no, we're going to infringe the autonomy of the university system in order to, these people are going to have to reapply for their jobs and whatever. I mean, and I think that people would say that was legitimate. I mean, there are times when government has to infringe, you know, yes, we'd like the institution to have autonomy, but if they are using that autonomy to violate the rights of individuals, then that can't be allowed to stand.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a failure to recognize that, you know, I'm a professor, I teach, and I guess this is true for you. I think you're in a public, I mean, everything in the UK is a public, right? we are professors, we teach, we do research, but we're also government bureaucrats. And when we're put on our government bureaucrat hat, we're not exercising, you know, when I got expelled from the curriculum committee for questioning the politicization of, you know, one of our curriculum requirements, people who expelled me were professors, but they weren't wearing their research hat or their teaching hat, they were wearing their government bureaucrat hat. And I mean, that seems more like a violation of free speech than an exercise, but I'm sure they see it differently, that my presence on the committee was oppressive.
It is a violation. And I mean, I think if it's a private university, there's much less that can be done because they have a kind of free associational right, and so the same rules don't apply. But in anything that's government funded, then there's definitely a role for government to. And the key is, it's not enough to put it on people to have to sue, because that's expensive and time consuming. And most people are just going to say, I'm not going to bother.
And most lawyers will tell you it's not worth your time, by the way.
Yeah. Whereas that's why you need a government body. It's a simple one call, one email, and they're right on top of the university, and it's fixed quickly. And it's sort of a very proactive approach that doesn't allow the authoritarians to breathe. I mean, that's essentially what you need. You need somebody who really believes in the mission, who is very much going to lead this office and sort of essentially lean on the universities. It's already having an effect in Britain, already making people relax a little bit. So you, in order to lift the chilling effect, you need to have actually paradoxically quite a chilling effect on the universities from the government. And it's, no, I really wish it didn't have to be that way, but there really is no other way, because we know, I've been head of department, I've been on these committees, you know, when you get people who are true believers in the social justice agenda, who want to abridge free speech to have decolonization of the curriculum or whatever it is, no one's going to speak up against them.
Yeah, we actually have, I have the list of all of our diversity and equity grants from the university administration, and we're literally paying people to decolonize their curriculums. So, and that's state money. That's not somebody doing their own thing with their own class. This is like, we're providing money that the taxpayers have provided to us to go out and we're giving people money to try to force other people to change their classes. And it doesn't, that doesn't seem like free speech to me. And it certainly seems like something that people in Texas should have a say in before they do that. But sorry, I'm a little Texas.
Well, yeah, because that's not being made, it's not being reported on to them, and the politicians are not raising the profile of the issue enough to them. So they're able to get away with it in the universities, right? So if that were exposed, made an issue now, if you look at, and this is, yeah, I mean, you can, there is some data on this already, but if you look at, say, a list of 24 issues. Harvard Harris did a poll, 24 issues. One of the issues was cancel culture / political correctness. And actually, that is a mid-ranking issue now in the United States. It is, for Republican voters, arguably in some surveys, it's scoring higher than moral values and religion. So it's got potential. The politicians, a lot of them, either they went into politics for other reasons to do with cutting taxes or religion or whatever, but not specifically on this issue. And what you kind of need to do is, what's happened with critical race theory in Virginia, for example, that needs to happen with cancel culture more generally. And the same if you look at the public opinion on it and how it breaks down by party, it's the same structure, very similar structure. This issue unites most conservative voters and it divides left-wing voters. And so it's a perfect, again, electoral issue. But what you need is to actually get some good policies there and get some politicians who can spearhead these policies and media that can get behind those policies and raise their profile. And then you need a policy network to staff the offices that can execute.
Sounds like a lot of work.
I know. But that's the only way I'm convinced of it. I know.
Well, I guess that's got us about to an hour. This was very fast hour. It's fascinating. Very good work. I'm very impressed with the sort of putting the nose to the grindstone and really documenting this stuff. So thanks again so much, Eric, for talking to us. And I look forward to future conversations. And maybe you'll be in Austin sometime.
Yeah, well, the University of Austin, right? So maybe once a year. Good, Richard. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.